Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings, Hotep. Thanks for joining the Care to Read Room. You have your Omega 7 live coming to you straight from my living room. I am the advocate you need and the advisor you want. I am your emperor. I'm here to serve you. Once again, we'd like to acknowledge all the teachers throughout the country, acknowledging them for a job well done. Teachers, pat yourself on the back. It is your time to shine now. And students, if you're out there, you ought to call a teacher or send an email to a teacher and thank her for all of the commitment that she's given you. Once again, mothers, if you're out there in the audience, I'd like you to gather your family around. I have family stories for you, for your youth, especially for the youth, the middle schooler and high schooler. And maybe the parents will benefit from these stories just as well. Our segment today is narrating of the life of Frederick Douglass. The objective of our whole mission to talk about Frederick Douglass is to learn about the important literary and historical future and figures of Douglass. We also want to appreciate the elegancy of a gifted writer and orator. He was a gifted orator and writer. And ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to also say that we appreciate Frederick Douglass for being gifted and an orator. And I'd like to also indicate we'd like to relate Douglass' narratives to our own lives. We'd like to relate his life to our own lives and talk about how our lives depict what Douglass' life was like. Now, we know it's a lot different because Douglass was a slave, of course. A lot of people did not realize that Douglass was a slave because he spoke so elegant. They thought he could not know the history of a slave because they felt he was a free man. We want to recognize the stylish devices and the parallels that are used throughout his storytelling. We want to understand and identify the kinds of conflicts that he goes through. And there will be many that he'll go through as we talk about his life. We'll recognize and understand the foreshadowing of the support of the opinions, the specific literaries, and all these things have been pinpointed for my objectives. I will be reading from the African American Literary Book. And this is a teacher's manual that is written for teachers. Okay, we want to understand and identify, and I quote, the kinds of conflicts and to recognize and understand how he got into the situation. Now, we won't be talking to you about writing in your personal journals today, but if you want to in the future, you can pinpoint certain points in your journal. And we want to perform a poem or play. Now, what we'll do is do a couple of poems because of the time constraints, and we'll read to you some poetry as well. Now, I'd like to just give you a little background information about who Frederick Douglass was, but before we do that, we'd like to go to station identification, and we'll come right back at you in the air with our talking cue. Stay tuned for Nettie's Teacher. Thank you. Welcome back, family, to the Care to Read Room. You have your own Inca 7 Live coming to you straight from my living room. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, we're acknowledging National Poetry Month, and we're also acknowledging Teacher Appreciation. And get your library cards and get on out to that library. I want you to call in if you're out there. We're going to be reading poetry. If you have a poem that you'd like to read this evening, we encourage you to do so. So lock the dial in. Lock that number in, 646-478-0270. In honor of National Poetry Month, I like to say I am an early literacy coach. I encourage mothers to increase the literacy in their home. We're closing the gap of disparity so that we will stop illiteracy from ramping throughout the school district. We are working towards creating literate parents. And as we create literate parents, they will create literate children. Yesterday, we talked a little bit about Sojourner Truth, and I don't know if I did her justice or not, but Sojourner Truth was born in 1792. She died in 1883 and she adopted her name, and that name was adopted. And she was born in New York and escaped from slavery shortly before the Emancipation Proclamation. So she left and went with Harriet Tubman and those guys to the States. Now, she gave speeches. She was an orator. She made her famous speeches in Ohio. And she wrote the poem, Ain't I a Woman? And I won't recite that today because of time constraints. You can go out and get that. Sojourner Truth, Mrs. Stowe Livian, that was her real name, Miss Stowe Livian Sibley, that was her real name. However, she adapted that name, and she used that name throughout her oratory. And I want you to also know that she worked seriously with the military and assisting the military, and I wanted you to know that because her mission was to bring about justice for all people of color, as well as people of other descendants. She worked feverishly for the military throughout and assisted and aided them. Now, we won't go into a full detail of Sojourner Truth. We do know that she was partnering with Harriet Tubman out there simultaneously doing the same thing. Sojourner Truth was born to do the kind of work she was doing. And also, she was really, really concerned about the conditions of the human race. And if you can go out and get her books, read as much as you can. I like to make a retraction here. Her name is Isabella. I noticed here I see her name is Isabella Balmtree. And apparently she had the ambition to be free, and she made her way to freedom. And we know that the story is written about her, how she stood 6 feet tall, and she basically was not literate, but she was very, very gifted in her orator. Okay? Now, I'd like to also say we're going to go on today to talk about Frederick Douglass, who was also in that era of time, along with Harriet Tubman. After escaping from slavery, Frederick Douglass quickly achieved the prominence as a writer and an orator. He was literate. White abolitionists took great pride in introducing ex-slaves to people who were gifted in writing. They were very, very fond of Frederick Douglass. Douglass was so elegant and powerful as a speaker that many detected that he might not have even been a slave. They thought that he was a free man. Partly in answer to these charges, Douglass wrote a series of autobiographical narrative, and they were not only detailed in pointing out his background, but several areas called action to what it was he was doing as an abolitionist. In 1845, he published the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, an American slave. He next published an enlarged autobiography, My Bondage and My Freedom. Then in 1881, he published his masterwork, The Life and Time of Frederick Douglass. Now let's do some focusing. This election prides itself on a good example of conflict. There was conflict going on in Frederick's life. The narrative also lands itself on a discussion of value problems. Now, and I quote, one of the things that Frederick was really concerned about is that people did not think that he was a slave. And Frederick carried himself in that way because he was amongst many men who were free, many men. Now, in presenting the selection, because the selection is the first-person narrative that is told in, with plenty of action, he writes with plenty of action, we should also focus in on the fact that this was a slave writing. Okay, let's address some of the differences of the level. Okay, some of your levels will be different when doing the reading. I know you're different age groups, and you will be reading at different age levels and grade levels. Now, I want you to understand that Frederick Douglass went through some challenges. Now, in identifying the facts, I want to go to the facts. You can look at some of the pages, like 178 when you get the book. Why was Douglass working for Carvey? Carvey was a gentleman he was working for. Why was he working for us? This was the owner. He was the owner, and he leased him out. He leased Frederick Douglass out for a certain period of time. In those days, you could lease slaves, so Frederick was leased out. Carvey was the one he was having the problem with. Why was he unable to complete his work in an exact time? What was the problem that was going on? There was some complication going on. Douglass was not used to do hard physical work, labor. He wasn't used to that. But he was contracted out. He became exhausted once after being contracted out to a certain slave master. And he was very, very tired. And what was his master's reaction when he came back to him complaining, telling him he was tired? Wouldn't you know it, his master denied that Carvey had mistreated him in any way and said that Carvey was a good man and ordered him to go back to Carvey to continue to work. Now, there was some advice that one of the gentlemen, there was some advice that was given to him, to Fred, because he could not seem to get through to his master about how Carvey was treating him. Sandy told him about some superstitions things and told him what he could do to help himself. And I quote, and he said, a certain root that would keep him from being beaten by the white man, he advised him to return to Carvey to carry the root in his right side. Now, in those days, the Africans believed very heavily in understanding the culture of roots and carrying rabbit foots and roots and juju bags for protection. They were always in danger, so they had to have something. So in Douglass's effort to protect himself, he planted the root on him. Douglass was not punished or beaten anymore by Carvey after he planted the root. What was the explanation that was given? Douglass believed that Carvey wanted to save face. That's why he didn't beat him anymore. And if he had sent Douglass to the whipping post, then everyone would know that he could not manage his slaves, and his reputation as a slave beater would be known. So he stopped whipping Frederick. Now, let's do some interpreting. Now, you have to interpret what you're reading. Why does Douglass consider his experience with Carvey to be a bad thing or a memorable event in the history? He made it a memorable event by standing up for himself is one of the reasons. Slaves did not fight back in those days. They took it like a man and did nothing for fear that they would lose their life. Douglass gained a sense of his own manhood, and he found self-confidence, and he found strength and inspired himself to escape from slavery. He felt that it was necessary to make him feel like a man. Sandy gave Douglass a root to carry in his pocket. That was part of what gave him strength, to believe that he would be protected. Now, how does this episode foreshadow or hint at what is to come? How does it give you an idea of what's going to happen next? Here's Douglass fighting back. He's carrying the root. He's being protected. What is he doing now? When Sandy tells him that carrying the root will protect him from whipping, the reader begins to expect that there will be another confrontation between Douglas and Kirby. Now, was there? No. There were no more confrontation. Trace the stages of the conflict. Let's go back between Douglas and Kirby. When the event began to happen, there was a climax of the situation. And Douglas fought Kirby back, indicating he came into realization that he felt like a man when he stood up for himself. Now, Frederick Douglass wasn't the only man to stood up for himself, but there were many. At what point is there a change in Douglass' attitude? The change occurs when Kirby has the rope around his leg and intends to thrash him. He was going to beat him, and he put the rope around his leg. What do you think happened? What happened? At that point, Douglass was looking for a fight to stand up for himself. Douglas calls the battle with Kirby the turning point in his career as a slave. That was a turning point. He was not going to take any more whippings, and he stood up. This being the turning point, he explained that this is why he could not take another whipping. In fighting back and overcoming Kirby, Douglas sees himself as a man now rather than an objective slave. Toward the end of the episode, Douglas says, I now resolve that however long I might remain a slave in the form, the day has passed forever when I could be a slave, in fact. Now, how do you interpret this, ladies and gentlemen? And what does this mean? Is this a form or fact? Although he might still be labeled as a slave by law, his spirit now soars free because he took a stand. What impression do you form of Douglas from his selection in taking a stand? I formed this impression. The answers will vary, I know, of course, from you. You might have different answers. However, I think that Douglas began to feel like he could now escape from slavery and be a man. Despite the terrible cruelty that he suffered, did you find this account of how a slave was made a man uplifting? A man came out of the situation because he stood up and he refused to take another whipping. And Frederick Douglass will go on, and his story will be told, literally told. Now, what I wanted to do is point out to you the conflict. The conflict was when he took a stand. It was a turning point. When you read the story and take some time to find out what about the great stories that Douglas wrote and the narratives, his autobiography. Research it all. I'm sure you will enjoy it. I hope you like that one. Ladies and gentlemen, I am going to go right into the other storytellers, the stories that I have for you. First, I have a short narrative, and then I'm going to do a poem, and I think you will like this. And three young men, let's see which one I'm going to read to you first. I'm going to read Beneath the Blazing Sun, and this is by Rex Ellis, and this is a prodigal son. You might have heard about the prodigal son in the Bible. If you just bear with me 1 minute here, ladies and gentlemen. Pardon me. All right, the prodigal son. The Bible speaks of the prodigal son. In the story, an arrogant son leaves his father's house to make it on his own. After many manifestations and misfortune, the son realizes that the most important thing in life was a loving family and home. Although the story of the prodigal son is ancient, arrogant son was continued to exist throughout the century, a source of concern for those who love them. They have caused many tears for mothers who have tried everything to persuade them to change their way, and sleepless nights for fathers who have blamed themselves for not being able to reach out to their sons. Here's a story for you. within a poem about one anonymous author's desire to help others avoid the pain and suffering that wayward children can cause. When I was in eighth grade, a math teacher named Jeffrey Williams recited a poem to me. We had finished our math. It was the end of the school year, and we had some time to kill. He asked the class if anyone had any poems they wanted to share. Now, here was a man who knew math so well that he taught it. I would always sit in the back of the class, hoping he wouldn't call on me. I was terrified of math, but came to so many of my friends, and simply concepts were so hard for me that I couldn't conceive it. I had to conceive that I wasn't able to do it. I just wasn't able to do it. And that was the difficult thing about math. I'd never be able to conquer it, so I dreaded Mr. Williams' class. He put me in algebra to do a problem on the board and flashed through the steps. It was like moving through the air for him. It was like struggling through quicksand for me. But that one day when we put the math books aside, he asked about the poetry. He asked about the poetry. Was anyone in class that could do poetry? Poetry. I never forgot the poetry I knew. I had been a poet since first grade. I always received a copy of the best in the country poem book because I always submitted a poem that was published, thus becoming recognized as one of the best young poets in the county. Poetry was my math. It was my moving through the air. Here was the man I feared the most offering me a chance to change his perception of me by letting me do something in this class that he didn't have to explain to me over and over and again. I jumped at the chance and recited one of my poems to the class. He seemed impressed, but then he did something I never would have expected. He recited a poem himself. It forever changed my jaundiced opinion of his ability as a teacher. The poem moved me such that I committed it to memory that night. It seemed to express all the same sentiments I knew many mothers in my neighborhood felt as they tried to deal with their sons. Mr. William had learned it when he was a boy, and he never knew who the author was. For me, it was also important because it spoke in a language, syntax, rhythm that obviously came from the black experience. That meant I didn't have to translate it into experience as we had to do with most of the poetry, poems, and plays that we studied in English class. That also meant that the poem established vivid and undergoing imagination for me, for those who one day would hear me tell it. Mr. William called it the dying boy's mistake. I'd like to read it for you, ladies and gentlemen. The dying boy's mistake. I have a sad, sad story to tell you. I hope that you will take it in, for it is a warning unto the nation, and especially to young men. Boys, I hope you will sit and listen to the story as it is said. For it came from the lips of a sick boy who was on his dying bed. He called his mother to his side to listen to his plea. He said, "Mom, I hope nobody has ever lived a life like me. Mother, you tried to raise me in a good old Christian way, but I never loved the church people and their old-timey ways. Morning, you give me money to put in Sunday school, but I lost it in an alley crap game. Though I knew it was against your rule, I studied my Sunday school lesson sitting around an old crap game so that when I returned home, I could tell you about Jesus' name. Mother, tell the boys to live the life and don't try to be fake. I'm on my dying bed and I've made a great mistake. I've spent my many days and nights drinking whiskey and swallowing gin. I thought those days were sweet. I thought they'd never end. Mother, I had you fooled. You thought I was living my best. But I've been eating many things to keep you from smelling my whiskey breath. I've danced and frolicked. Worldly things I did not dread. But after all, what did they profit me? I'm on my dying bed. The boys would come to see me. They would knock at my door. I mean then and kept ready. I was always ready to go. They would come to see me when I was well and up on my feet. You could hear them whistling and calling way down the street. They won't even stop me and send me a postcard now. They won't even drop me or send me a postcard now. To see how I'm getting along, they realize that my health is bad. And they know that my money is gone. But, Mother, I'm dying. The room grows darker and cold. I've kept up with the world. But today I'm losing my soul. It seems as if I can hear the angel saying, too late, too late, too late. It's not your fault, dear Mother, but my own great mistake. I like to read you A Mother's Love. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not certain if we're going to have time for A Mother's Love. We'll probably continue that on tomorrow. But what I'd like to say is I'd like to give some input on the story. Frederick Douglass has no real connection to the poem I just read to you from The Dying Boy. But what it does have is that every day we die a little. But we must take a stand for something in order to live. This young man had traded his life off for a life of a prodigy son. And as he told the story in the poem, he realized that his time was too late. He had no time left to do anything. And he wanted to send a warning back to the young men. I think Frederick Douglass is also sending a warning to our young men out there to stand for what you believe and don't let anyone make you back down. And when your back is against the wall, to stand up, even if you have to fight. Now, what the mother is trying to say, or what the boy is saying here at the prodigy story, is a long-standing story that has been told many times about the prodigy son. But I think it's sent a message to the young boys out there. Don't start drinking early. Don't start rising early to give strong drink to your neighbor. And don't partake of strong drink, because you only are to give strong drink to those who are perishing, thus says the Bible. So for those young men who are taking alcohol as if it is a given and that it is something natural, African Americans, of course, have to understand that in our bloodline, some African Americans don't understand what alcohol does in the bloodline to an African American. And habitually getting addicted to alcoholic beverages is not good. So in this story, as I was going to tell you, the story of another little boy who got involved with drinking at an early age and began to start to drink throughout high school, taking in drinks, sneaking drinks, stealing money to buy drinks, and became addicted. And so addicted that he was always out of it. Out of his mind, never knew what was happening, so he could float through society. He joined a gang eventually and got involved with the gang, not knowing that this gang could viciously harm people. His family became concerned, and they spoke out on his behalf, so much till the sister went to the house of the gang member and pleaded with them to leave her brother alone. that particular night, they cautioned her of her strong words, and they stabbed her to death and left her out in the streets for dead. She managed to get back home long enough for her godmother to send her to the hospital. However, her brother saw the ambulance at her house as he was on his way home, and as he got there, he realized that it was his sister. She died that night. None of the family wanted to see him anymore. They separated themselves from him. He then began to drink heavier and heavier as he got older, up into his 50s. He eventually started to realize what the drinking had did to his family and how he joined the gang without realizing the gang would kill his sister. He got out of the game, of course, but he didn't get out of the game of lecturing and telling his story, trying to win a soul and prevent the young boys from going the direction he went. As a prodigal son would do, the lessons that they learned, they would take on and carry them over to tell someone else to prevent them from going down the same road. He began to tell his story throughout life to tell them to remember that family is very important and that in the end, the only thing that really counts is family. And that is the only thing that really counts, young men and young women. And I'm speaking to both of you young men who are of age, middle school, high school, to even think about taking a drink. Don't even think about taking your first drink, because alcohol can be addictive and wine can be addictive. And don't take it for socialization, because that is not necessary, because strong drink is raging. It will cause you to rage. Stay far away from it. And if your parents tell you it's not something you should partake of, don't partake of it. And try to use your own brain and don't put yourself into such a funk that you don't know what's going on. Most of the time, this young guy didn't even know what was going on. He was out of it. He didn't want to feel anymore because his mother and father had died, and he felt that, you know, that this was the end of it. His godmother was raising him. But he was very, very fortunate that he had his sister who was raising him and helping him. He was very fortunate to have people that loved him. Now, what I want to say as a moral of this story is that the prodigal sons are all over the place. And mothers, you don't have to have a son to be a prodigal son. It could be a female. It's very important that you speak to your children early on in life about strong drink and try to tell them that their body is a temple and that they are to honor their bodies and that these bodies don't belong to them. And I want to tell you that if you want to get on that love train, you can get on that love train. It doesn't have to be on a train going down the wrong direction. I think we're going to see if that train is out there now. It might be out there coming down the road. And if they're down there, I think I hear the train coming. It's time to get on the train. It's time to get out of here. Our time is up here, ladies and gentlemen. I'm about to get on that train. Those men are bringing it in. Come on. Get on the love train. Stray away from outward living, young men and women. Find a lifestyle that's good to live. Get on the train with me. Going down love train, people. All right, Mom. Thank you so much for your time this evening. Our time is up here. And we got to go. Gotta go. Get out of here. Thank you. Have a great evening. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back here tomorrow, same time, same place. Why don't you join us for an evening of storytelling and reading? And to those of you who are poets, come on into the room. Bring your poetry in. I'll be glad to have you. Recite your poetry. And if you are poet in the making, here's the room to be. Come on into the Care to Read room. We're a literary group here, and we don't inspire to critique you and criticize you. We'll encourage you to keep writing your poetry. I'm poet also. We all have to have new beginnings. In this room, we're starting new beginnings. But those of you who pin your poetry away and you've never recited before, come on into the Care to Read room. This is a new beginning for us as we go through this year in our unleavened bread and celebrating the feast of unleavened bread, our feast of our first fruit, and also the feast of gathering. African Americans, you ought to stay into ritual. We didn't do our libation, but we're going to try and get our libation in before we leave here today. And I'd like to stop and say, for all of you mothers out there, Stop and preach the word to your children. Speak blessings over them. I speak blessings over your household. And if it be inshallah, I will see you tomorrow. And I ask you to all the time follow your ancestors. Set your altars up. Make sure you acknowledge your ancestors and calling their name. All the more acknowledge God over the one way. All the way. God has resigned to you in a form of black African prophets. They have a name. Yes, they do. Acknowledge them. And oftentimes, remember your ancestors. They are not dead. They yet live. And we cannot die, but we live in the realm of ancestors. Once again, thank you so very much. And have a great evening. I'll see you tomorrow.